Thank you for the invitation to give this talk. You're probably wondering what more is there possibly to say about type 1a supernovae and rates, and I think the answer is not very much. So this talk is really about the stellar populations of the type 1a supernovae, with a little bit about the rates of subluminous 1991 BG-like supernovae towards the end of the talk. So you know, basically the questions that I'm going to look at in this talk are: how do the progenitor stellar populations influence supernova 1a properties, and are there any consequences of this influence of the stellar populations or the progenitors on the application of type 1a supernovae in cosmological analyses? And then, as I said at the end, I'm going to talk very briefly about subluminous supernova search that we've done with the SNLS data quite recently. So, you know, as we all know, when you do cosmology with type 1a supernovae, you have to standardize the magnitudes or the peak luminosities of the events using empirical relationships to decrease the scatter in the peak luminosities on the Hubble diagram. And so there are two basic relationships that are used by pretty much every light curve fitter or analysis technique out there. The first is the classic Phillips relation, where brighter supernovae have wider and slower light curves. And then the second is a color luminosity relationship, where brighter supernovae have bluer colors. As I say, there are many techniques in cosmology which are used. There's a small list of them there. There are more than that. And even though different techniques parameterize the light curve width and the color in different ways, and they have different notations for writing these types of equations down, most of them make a correction to the peak luminosities, where you have some coefficient, you know, in either linear or quadratic form multiplied by the light curve width, and then some coefficient times the color of the supernova. And in this talk, I'm going to be talking about this alpha and this beta. So the alpha parameterizes the stretch luminosity relationship, and then this beta parameterizes the color luminosity relationship. And when you do the cosmology, of course, so firstly, these are empirical relationships, but it should be said that they capture most of the variation in type 1a supernova properties. But that the second thing is that these relationships are assumed to be universal, and therefore are assumed not to evolve with redshift. And bearing in mind some of the talks that we had this morning and in the afternoon, this is a big assumption in supernova cosmology that really has to be tested with the, you know, the current generation of supernova data that we have. So this is we haven't seen a Hubble diagram today, so I thought it might be worth putting one up. So this is a typical supernova 1a Hubble diagram. So it's the peak magnitude of the supernova against its redshift. And so there is about 500 supernovae on here from various samples like SNLS, SDSS, a high redshift HST search, and of course the low redshift samples of Hicken et al. And Jar et al. And Ries et al. Now, when you look at this plot, the thing to take away is that the typical scatter on this type of diagram is about 0.14 magnitudes. So that is a pretty small scatter, and some of this scatter is due to observational uncertainties on the supernovae themselves. And when you look at the extra scatter that is unaccounted for by the observational errors, the number is about 0.1 magnitudes. So that means that supernova distances are generally accurate to 5 or 6% in distance, or about 0.1 magnitudes in peak luminosity. That means that any age or metallicity systematic in the type 1a supernova population is, by necessity of that number, is going to have to be pretty subtle. So we're searching for quite small effects in the supernova population. So this is the light curve width luminosity correction. So what you're looking at here is the stretch of the supernova going from the narrow, fast supernovae to the wide and slow supernovae. This is the light curve, parameterizes the width of the light curve against the Hubble residual. So this is the residual from the Hubble diagram. And so in this plot, you're looking at the relationship before you make the correction for light curve shape, the stretch luminosity relationship, and this is after you make that linear correction. So this is the classic Phillips relation, of course. It's almost certainly an intrinsic relationship of the supernova, But you know, there's a few questions. Why does it have this form? Why should it be linear in magnitude space? And you know, is this relationship really invariant with the age or metallicity of the supernova progenitor star? The color correction, this is that brighter supernovae have bluer light curves. So here you're looking at the Hubble residual before you've applied the color correction. And you know, here you might imagine that if there's dust along the line of sight to the supernova, that would make supernova both fainter and redder. But if this were Milky Way dust, you would expect the slope of this relationship, this is constructed in the B-band, and against essentially a B minus V color, you would expect this slope to be about 4. In reality, it's closer to 3. A slope of 4 is that red line there. So you know, this is very confusing because it means that this relationship does not behave as you would expect for Milky Way dust. That is a statement that is true for all light curve fitters, as far as I'm aware. And so you know, there's no good explanation as to why this is the case. It could be a mixture of extinction along the line of sight to the supernova, modulated or modified by some intrinsic color-luminosity relationship of the supernova itself that does not correlate with light curve shape. It could be that the dust near supernovae is different to the general dust population of the Milky Way, for example, with the circumstellar dust around the supernova explosion. Or it could just be that dust in the Milky Way, where we expect this R sub B of 3.1 or R sub B of 4.1, is just different to dust in every other galaxy. So this is an interesting paper by Dan Kaysen, which came out recently. And you know, it seems that theoretical predictions are now, they're certainly getting the sense of both of these relationships pretty close to what they are in the observations. So here, you're looking at delta M against peak magnitude. So you know, this is different to stretch, but it's the same idea. You see this relationship from Dan's models, where the slope of this relationship, if you plot it in, or do the maths in terms of stretch, is about 2.25. This is the color against the luminosity, and the slope is about 4.45. So certainly, theoretical models can reproduce the sense of these empirical relationships that we see in the data. The magnitude of the two relations is not exactly the same, but even so, I think this is you know, pretty good progress that the theory is really catching up with the observations now. But this is all intrinsic to the supernova, so there's no dust on this, and it's interesting that there is a strong intrinsic color luminosity relationship apparent for the type 1a supernovae. So as we saw earlier, so why will we be worried in terms of cosmology? Well, we know that the light curve shape or the stretch of the supernova is strongly dependent on the host galaxy characteristics. In this case, this is the luminosity weighted age of the galaxy. So this is SNLS data. And you see, as we saw in Peter Ganovich's talk, that most of these bright luminous supernovae reside in quite young galaxies. And you have this population of fainter a supernovae with narrower light curves that reside in these older host galaxies. With color, there's no real trend. So the color, the trend with stretch, I think, was quite obvious. Here, there's no evidence for any strong relationship between the color of the supernova and the host galaxy age, which is interesting in and of itself, because you might naively expect there to be more extinction in these younger galaxies. Younger galaxies tend to be more strongly star-forming. They tend to have more dust. And so you might expect there to be redder supernova located in these galaxies. But it turns out that we don't see that in the data. We don't see that supernovae are particularly bluer in older galaxies either. So what else do we know? We know the relative mix of the two young and old supernovae will change with redshift. This is a plot which uses the A plus B model, but it's basically generic for any model of the supernova progenitor. You, at a high redshift, you're bound to have more younger supernovae that follow the star formation history. That's that dashed line. And at low redshift, you'll have more of these older supernovae that follow the buildup of stellar mass in the universe. And that's that dotted line. And we know that the light curve shape is dependent on these two components. So you have the brighter supernovae will follow this younger prompt component. And these fainter supernovae, or low stretch, will follow this delayed component. And this has actually been detected. You predict a mean stretch evolution with redshift because of this, and this has been detected in supernova data. That has implications in terms of other ways in which supernova might evolve with redshift. We know by looking at low redshift and high redshift spectra of supernova that some of the chemical features, in particular the intermediate mass elements such as silicon 2, the equivalent width of silicon 2, is dependent on the type of galaxy in which the supernova explodes. So this is work by Justin Brunder, but there are other papers out there that show similar effects. So this is the equivalent width of, relative to some mean number of the of low redshift, and this is at high redshift, and the field histogram, which way around is it? The open histogram is elliptical and S0 galaxies, and the spirals are in the field histogram, and you can see that there is a difference in the sense that you have stronger silicon equivalent width in elliptical galaxies, and a weaker silicon equivalent width in elliptical galaxies. So this indicates that you get more intermediate mass elements in fainter or smaller nickel mass supernovae. And of course, if you expect the stretch, therefore, to evolve with redshift, you might expect that the silicon or some of the spectra will change subtly with redshift as well. And there's some tantalizing evidence if you compare the mean spectra of supernovae in different redshift bins. So the blue here is at low redshift, so you really need to concentrate on this part. The UV data is not very well constrained at low redshift. But you see in this silicon feature at 4,000 angstroms, which is a feature that is common across the entire redshift range, that you see in the red spectrum, which is the mean redshift greater than 1 type 1a supernova spectrum, you see much weaker silicon. And if you measure this feature, then you can see that the silicon 2 equivalent width does indeed decrease with increase in redshift in the same sense as you would expect based on the evolving stretch model. So what does that mean in terms of cosmology? So all of these different things that are going on in the supernova population, when we come to do the analysis, the cosmological analysis, we're assuming that we can take out all of these different effects to do with progenitors and ages and possibly metallicities. So what you're looking at here is just for the SNLS sample, so there's no other supernova shown here, so and it's a fixed cosmological model. So this is a Hubble residual relative to some lambda CDM model. And each of these black points is one of the SNLS supernovae plotted against the age of its host galaxy. And then the red are the mean mean residuals as a function of age in different age bins. And we have applied the stretch and color correction to this diagram. So this is as would be used in a cosmological analysis. And you see, well, I don't know, whether you think there's something there or not, I don't know. I think there probably is a subtle trend that after you make the light curve shape and color correction, the supernova in the younger galaxies tend to appear fainter by about 0.05 magnitudes. It's significant at about 2 or 2.5%. It is driven by these supernovae in the older galaxies. So you know, I'll show you a different way of looking at this data in a moment. And here, you're assuming that the alpha and the beta for the entire population is the same. So they have a universal alpha, which is the stretch luminosity coefficient, and a universal beta. Of course, that might not be true. It's worth noting that in the Hicken et al. Low redshift data, they see the same trend in the same sense. So this is the plot from Hicken et al. So you're looking at the Hubble residual again against morphological type of the host galaxy, and it's noisy, but you see a trend of about the same significance with these brighter supernovae in elliptical galaxies. This is the same thing done with a different light curve fitter, it's the same data, and you know the trend is probably there at some low significance. So you can now we can identify old supernovae in old galaxies versus supernovae in young galaxies. You can fit independent alphas, which is the stretch relationship, and independent betas, the color relationship, for the two different types of supernovae in the two different types of hosts. And so this is the plot. This is stretch against the Hubble residual with no stretch correction. And of course, you know, the supernovae in old hosts tend to have lower stretches. But you see slopes here that are quite consistent with each other. This shows how it depends on how you define old or young. So we take a default split point of, I think it's about 1.5 gigayears here. And you know there are some differences, but they're not particularly significant. And clearly, the significance does depend on where you make this split point. So for example, if you make it here, you get a more significant result than if you make it here. So probably there's not a great deal going on in this diagram. You can compare that to what theory, again, this is Dan Kaysen's models, to what is predicted based on some of the newer models that are around. So I had to flip the diagram because this was the decline rate against magnitude. So to get it in the same sense as the one we were looking at before, you have to rotate this by 180 degrees. And you know, in that paper they predicted about a 2% effect, and I'd say that's consistent with what we see in the data. We certainly can't rule this out based on the current data that we currently have. But more interesting, I think, is the color relation. And now if you begin to look at how the slope of the color luminosity relation depends on supernovae in different host types, you do begin to see something a bit more interesting. So this is the supernova color against the luminosity of the supernova again, and the red points are supernovae in old galaxies, and the blue points are supernovae in young galaxies, and you definitely see different slopes for the color luminosity relationship, which are really quite significant. This is, you know, 4 or 5 sigma significance here. And I get here, it doesn't depend at all on, you know, particularly how you define old versus young. And it's worth noting that this goes in the sense that you might expect, in that you're seeing a steeper slope in the younger, presumably star-forming galaxies, and that beta of 3.5 is getting quite close to the Milky Way beta of 4.1. But it's also interesting that in the passive galaxies, you still see this strong intrinsic, well, presumably if there's no dust in these galaxies, an intrinsic color relation in the supernova with a slope of about 2.4, which I guess is quite different from the models, but you know, is in the same sense as the models. And it's, I think, another interesting result that came out recently was this paper by Wang et al., and where they looked at high-velocity type 1a supernovae. So this is looking at the silicon 6150 or 6355 feature, and they showed that in supernovae which have high-velocity silicon features, you get a smaller R sub V. And this looks actually pretty similar to the relationship that I showed just now, with the, you know, these red points are the high-velocity supernovae, and in those supernovae you also see this flatter beta or R sub V slope. So it's interesting to try and work out whether there's any correspondence between these supernovae and the ones that you see in the galaxies that are determined to be passive. So you can say, well, what's the effect on the cosmology? So now you're looking at the absolute magnitude of the supernova in different galaxy types, so the young ones and the old ones again. And you know, the relation, there are differences at about 0.05 magnitudes, again, something between 2 and 2.5 sigma difference. And it doesn't depend where you make this split. You also note that the scatter on the Hubble diagram is considerably lower for supernovae in older galaxies. It's about 0.11 to 0.12 compared to the sample average of about 0.14. And it's definitely higher in the spiral galaxies. And again, you might expect this if there's more dust in the spirals, which is diminishing your ability to correct the supernovae. And so that just shows, you know, how the scatter decreases with as you go into older galaxies. So this dashed line is the split point between the two samples, and these supernovae tend to have a larger scatter, a higher RMS, which decreases as you go to the supernovae in the older system. So you do see this gradual decreasing in the RMS as you go to supernova in older host galaxies. So to summarize that standardization part of the talk then, I think that you know, it's very difficult to test for the cosmological effects of these two different components for the type 1a supernovae in cosmology. I think, you know, there's some evidence for differences in the nuisance parameters, particularly in the color luminosity relationship, and perhaps in the corrective magnitudes. It is in the same sense that has been seen before, but it's not clear whether this is a property of the supernova themselves, whether there's more than one type of supernova 1a explosion, whether this is something about the galaxies and their environments, for example, the amount of dust in the galaxies, or whether this is just some problem with light curve fitting techniques. I mean, it could be all three, or it could be none of those. Okay, so as promised then, in the last 2 or 3 minutes, something on the type 1a supernova rates. So we've seen volumetric rates before in the last talk from Ben. So this is the number of supernovae per year per cubic megaparsec against the redshift. And this is like the existing, anything not in red is existing published data. And then these red points are a new analysis from the Supernova Legacy Survey by Kathy Perrett, which should be submitted very soon. This is for normal type 1a supernovae with stretches between 0.8 and 1.25. So these are the ones that are used in the cosmology. There's no subluminous supernovae in this plot. And in fact, you see quite a subtle evolution in the volumetric supernova rate with redshift. And indeed, at about a redshift of 1, this rate is quite a lot lower than has previously been published. So, you know, the interesting thing that we can, well, I guess there's one other thing, is you can do the standard A plus B fit to the volumetric rate evolution. So we include the low redshift SDSS points here, as well as the SNLS data. And we, you know, do this A times mass plus B times star formation rate fit, and you get coefficients that are quite similar to what has been found before. So, you know, so this data is quite consistent with this idea of two components, one depending on, you know, old stars and one depending on young stars. But of course, we don't include the subluminous supernovae in this analysis because in SNLS, we don't spectroscopically confirm subluminous supernovae because they're too difficult to observe. So these subluminous supernovae tend to be about 2 magnitudes fainter than the normal type 1a supernovae. They're much faster, have narrower light curves, and they tend to be redder. And so you can see some work on the rise times of these subluminous supernova on a poster by Santiago Gonzalez, which is outside. The spectra show titanium and enhanced silicon, and the classic example is this 91BG object, and they're usually found in old stellar populations. So we don't have any spectroscopically confirmed subluminous supernovae at high redshift. It's not obvious why. They could be too faint to find, they could be too faint to spectroscopically confirm, or they may just not exist, the decay time is just too long, and you know they have this different type of progenitor. So this is work that's been done by Santiago again, and what he has done is he has searched in the SNLS data to try and photometrically identify the subluminous supernovae, which are defined here as a stretch of less than 0.8, and so these are not objects that are used in the cosmological analysis. And so he developed various new techniques in terms of stretch luminosity and color luminosity, and used photometric redshifts of the host galaxies and various other bells and whistles in order to try and identify these low stretch supernovae photometrically in the data. And so this is the result of the analysis. So this shows that the supernova photoses, you know, are pretty good. They correspond very well with the spectroscopic redshifts. And then these are he found about 18 subluminous type 1a supernova candidates out to a redshift of about 0.6. This is their redshift histogram. The low stretch supernovae, these black ones here, compared to the entire population of type 1a supernovae. And you can see this more clearly in the stretch histogram. So this is the spectroscopically confirmed type 1As. And then these are the extra low stretch ones that were found in this search for photometric subluminous supernovae. It's worth noting that it only goes down to about a stretch of 0.6. So we don't find the really, really subluminous ones. And I think 91BG has a stretch of about 0.6. So we're really looking at this intermediate range between genuinely subluminous and just, you know, slightly faint. So, you know, how do we know that these really are subluminous supernovae? We look at their host galaxy properties, and in particular, we look at their stellar masses and their specific star formation rates. So the blue here are the entire population, and then these red hashed histograms are the candidate subluminous supernovae which Santiago identified. And what you can see, well, you probably can't see it in this diagram, but all of the subluminous candidates tend to reside in very massive host galaxies, and they tend to be quite passive. They don't tend to have much star formation. And you can see there's quite a big difference between these low-stretch supernovae, which are in red, and these high-stretch supernovae, which are in blue. So this gives a lot of confidence that these subluminous things, which we've photometrically identified, you know, really are subluminous supernovae. And finally, the last plot then is, if you look at the volumetric rate evolution for these subluminous supernovae as a function of redshift. So this is the Perrot et al. Data from the full SNLS sample of stretch 0.8 to 1.2. And then this is Santiago's results. And what he finds is, you know, there are subluminous supernovae at high redshift, these 91BG-like supernovae. They show a very flat evolution with redshift. It's about a 30% correction to the A component in terms of the A plus B model. And, you know, if you do a delay time calculation of these supernovae, you end up with delay times of about 2 to 4 gigayears for various Gaussian or exponential delay time distributions. So, you know, these exist at high redshift, and that probably says something about the ages of the progenitors, in that they can't be as old as something like 10 gigayears, because we wouldn't see them at these redshifts. So I'll leave that plot there, and that's the end.
The results with the different beta values for the passive and the star-forming galaxy is very interesting. Is there some circularity in how you do that analysis? Because, right, you have to use, first you have to correct them for your stretch relation, right, before you could work out what the residual versus color is. And the stretch relation, you have to first have you have to learn that from the supernovae, so there's already some color information that is built into how you define the stretch relation. So it wasn't clear to me, maybe you have it right, but that there isn't some circularity in how you first start out with, you know, developing or training those relations free from color before you learn the color relation.
Well, of course, this is using the simultaneous fit. So you fit for the alpha and the beta at the same time on all of the supernovae that fit the criteria. So for example, you could do it for the entire sample, or you could just do it for those in spiral galaxies.
But in multiple colors?
Well, you can't do it in multiple colors for most of the supernovae in SNLS because you don't observe multiple colors. What we do is we combine, say, different colors. So we convert everything to the rest frame. And if you have a U minus B and a B minus V, we convert that into a single color estimator. The data are not really good enough to do this in multiple colors at the moment. I don't think it's circular because you use exactly the same technique for supernovae in the old galaxies as you do for those in the young galaxies. So you're doing the same simultaneous fit, but on a different sample of supernovae. So it's exactly the same way that the cosmology is done in the, you know, the SALT or SIFTO way of doing things.
Right, but if there's more mean extinction in the star-forming galaxies, if it were the case that there was more mean extinction for those galaxies, then whatever the intrinsic color relation error is, you might make more of it in one population than the other?
It's possible, but any linear relationship between stretch and color comes out in the fit anyway. So if there's anything above and beyond a linear relationship between stretch and color, that will be a problem. Now, I actually have, thought you might ask that question. So I actually have that here. So this is the stretch color relationship for all of the SNLS, actually it's all the SNLS and low redshift data. So this is the, you know, stretch against color. We don't see a lot of relationship between the stretch and the color of the supernova. So, you know, I'm not saying that you can't be right, but I don't see how that it would obviously happen in our data.
So, Mark, can you go back to your last slide? I'm just curious if you really are probing the 91BG like population, given your stretch value, because I mean maybe I'm reading this wrong, but it looks like you're detecting these out to redshift of 0.9, and it seems like, you know, if it's really a 91BG like object, you shouldn't be detecting it out.
I would say it's the subluminous population. So it's intermediate between a 91BG and a supernova that would be used in the cosmology.
Okay. So, but what do you say subluminous is here?
So it's in fact, it turns out to be the point at which the relationship between stretch and luminosity becomes nonlinear. So if you look at the stretch luminosity relationship, the relationship gets steeper at about a stretch of 0.8. 0.8 is typically the lowest stretch that we spectroscopically confirm in SNLS. So we're basically looking at supernova which are fainter than those that we would normally detect. Okay. So are they as faint as genuine 91BGs? They have stretches of about 0.5, 0.6, so probably there are not that many of those, you know, quite extreme examples in the data.
So let me go back to the thing you just said before this, the relationship between the stretch and the color index. Theoretically we would, from the theoretical plots of Dan's that you showed, don't we expect a correlation here?
I don't know. I haven't. I don't. Dan, is Dan in here? Maybe he knows.
So does that mean that all the color here is due to extinction, or what does that mean?
I don't know. What does it mean? I don't know what it means, but certainly there's extinction on this data, which is not on Dan's models, so that will cloud it to some degree. Well, you're looking at raw stretch versus raw color here.
Yeah. So if all these supernovae were unextincted magically,
you may or may not see a relation that is consistent with Dan's. Yeah. I don't know.
Okay. All right, great afternoon.